You may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Tom Liebrich. I'm a lawyer from Lynchburg, and I'm here representing, actually his name is Robert Kennedy, in this appeal from the Nelson Circuit Court. Your Honors, this is, I believe, a case that exhibits a conflicting line of cases that we have in Virginia with regards to extrinsic evidence and how it can be used to establish whether or not a writing is or is not a will. In this particular case, there was an order from the clerk denying the probate of the will. That was appealed to the circuit court. And so then the issue becomes whether it's a will or whether it's not a will. Judge Garrett relied on Samuel versus Hunter's executor or executrix, which essentially stands for the proposition that declarations regarding the knowledge or lack of knowledge of the extrinsic evidence or existence of such a will comes into evidence. But, Your Honors, that case, there was independent evidence tending to show that the writing was a forgery. It's the genuineness of the will must be called into question. That's juxtaposed to a long line of cases here in Virginia that says you cannot admit extrinsic evidence in the sole issue of whether or not a will is or is not a will. And so, Your Honors, if you start with the Horn case, the sole issue in probate proceedings is whether the paper is or is not a will. You go to Payne versus Rice, extrinsic evidence not admissible, either to prove or disprove whether or not it's a will. Tompkins versus Randall, testamentary intent means the testator intended the very paper to be his will. Mumaugh, testamentary evidence must be found on its face, not by the extrinsic evidence the proponent attempts to put into evidence. Your Honors, I would ask the court to consider the Rule versus First National Bank case. And in that case, there's a disposition by Professor Graves regarding the two types of extrinsic evidence. We have facts and circumstances that he divides extrinsic evidence into. In other words, who's the testator? Who are family members? Who are claimants? What is the relationship? And in those cases, Professor Graves says, well, that type of extrinsic evidence is admissible if you to prove whether or not it is a will or is not a will.
But didn't the trial judge here expressly state that he or she was not considering this evidence other than for its genuineness, probative value? Not on the merits, not for testator's intent, but just for the genuineness issue.
In the Hunter case?
No, in our case, your case.
Oh, well, yes, sir. The judge said that it was corroborating, it was used to show state of mind, which follows the Hunter's case. But, Your Honor, in Hunter, there was evidence of fraud that was propounded by the other side. In this case...
But follow the logic of that. If he says, I'm not considering it on the merits, I'm not considering it for testator intent, I'm only considering it for genuineness. And your point is, well, that really wasn't in contest. All right, so what? He considered it for something that didn't matter. But he didn't consider it for the thing that did matter and you shouldn't do, which is testator intent. So I'm not sure where the argument goes.
Well, Your Honor, in this case, the proponent of the, well, the opposite side, in other words, Mr. Kennedy, did not present any evidence to the court whatsoever in the trial. And so there were issues raised on cross-examination, but there was never an issue. And, in fact, counsel conceded that there wasn't an issue towards the end of the case, that there wasn't an issue regarding a testamentary intent and that type of thing. And so,
but your very cross-examination challenged the genuineness of the document. You questioned
the pagination, you question the lack of numbers at the bottoms of the page, you question the ability to use a computer to put in pages that did not exist. So the very nature of the cross-examination, didn't that question the genuineness of the document?
Well, I think counsel was trying to raise some issues regarding that, but he didn't present any evidence in his case in chief. He didn't present any evidence. He moved. Well, I don't even. I guess he moved to strike after the conclusion of the proponent's evidence. But that was it. There was no evidence presented other than the questions during cross-examination, which did. And I think that those issues go again to the validity of the will. I think he was addressing the authenticity of the will when counsel was asking those questions about the whether it was stapled and the
help me with validity, authenticity, and genuineness. Where is the line drawn between authenticity, validity, and genuineness?
Well, it's sort of, I guess, all in the same. I'm not sure I can draw that that line, Your Honor. But I think there is a difference, though, in whether you've got the document, which is whether it's an authentic document, which is the second part of the argument that we're making, as opposed to whether or not the document is actually a will. And in my mind, this long line of cases stands for the proposition that you just cannot put extrinsic evidence in to determine whether or not the writing is or is not a will. It should you should be limited to the four corners of the document.
So the rule of law is you can't use extrinsic evidence to determine testator intent, right?
Well, yes, sir.
The trial judge says, I didn't do that. I let it in, but for some other reason. Now, the other reason may be debatable, but he's flat out saying he did not use this evidence on the merits to determine testator intent. So where's the error?
Well,
unless we just disbelieve the trial judge, and if that's what you think, go ahead and
say it. The error, Your Honor, would be that he relied on the Samuel versus Hunter's executive case as opposed to this longer line of cases that says that you can't do it. And that's what I'm saying. I think that there's this conflicting line of cases. I'm not sure that the two...
But he let it in on genuineness, and your point is that wasn't in controversy. So the next question is, so what? Okay, if it wasn't in controversy, he let it in on something that didn't matter, where's the error?
Well...
Or where's the harm, anyway?
And again, Your Honor, the harm is that if the document comes in, even though this extrinsic evidence comes in, the issue would be is the trial judge unduly influenced by that evidence, which ought not to come in, even though I understand.
Well, he's already said, I'm not influenced at all. I mean, again, we're inviting, if you believe that there's some reason not to believe what the judge said on the record, then tell us. But otherwise, if I look, you've invited us to look at the four corners of the document, and our jurisprudence does not require initials on each page. It's three pages. It appears to be one document. The judge even held the three pages up to make sure that the staple holes aligned, did he not?
Yes, sir.
And the judge says, looks like a will to me. And you've got the, and it wasn't self-proven, so you've got the witnesses who come in, and none of them have alleged any sort of impropriety. What conclusion can we reach other than the judge says, I wasn't influenced by anything that was extraneous, and I was influenced by everything that was intrinsic, and everything that's intrinsic lines up just like those staple holes line up?
Well, yes, sir. I understand the court's position on that. But again, I just reiterate that evidence... It was not It was irrelevant to the issue of whether it was a will or not a will based on the line of cases.
Where is the evidence in this case that it is not a will?
Well, Your Honor, it's I'm not saying it's not a will in our argument. I'm just saying that the cases conflict.
Maybe they do, maybe they don't. Where in this case is the evidence that it's not a will? The court made a finding of fact. It is a will.
Yes, sir.
Based upon the following evidence.
Well,
is there no basis to attack that finding of fact?
Then, Your Honor, I think perhaps it goes to this notion of authentication. And in I just wanted to point out, Your Honor, I'm going to rely on the brief, and I'd like to reserve a few minutes here for rebuttal. But with respect to the authentication, Your Honor, the will, and it's Mr. Brannick, the proponent's counsel, raised it several times through the trial about the internal consistency or inconsistency of the document. And I just wanted to raise that the document itself, it seems to me, is inconsistent in that it gives all discretion, all power to the executrix when it also says if the son repays some debts and if he does this and if he does that, then the testator says, well, he can have this, that, or the other, but then the will also says...
Where is that in your assignments of error?
Your Honor, in my assignment of error, that would be in the second assignment.
Says it's talking about authentication.
Well, yes,
it's
sir.
It's not talking about whether it meets the requirements in terms of what the executor can or cannot do.
Yes,
sir. That doesn't relate to authentication, does it?
In a broad way, in this, if authentication also deals with the unified document, then I think it was brought up, but I think Mr. Drury mentioned it on page 92, assuming the proposed document is found to be a unified testamentary document. And the opposing counsel brought up on many occasions that it was a unified document. And I just, the point being, Your Honor, that the document in itself is inconsistent because of the power that's given to the executrix, which is then eviscerated, or whatever bequest to the son is eviscerated by the power given to the executrix because she can or cannot. It's up to her. She's given total discretion. So, Your Honors, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
You're 1:58.
It pleases the court. I'm Boyce Brannick on behalf of Cheryl Hamlin, the appellee. For at least 160 years, this court has upheld the validity of written wills conforming with the requirements of what is now known as Virginia Code Section 64.2-403, subsections A and C. An historic link of cases from at least Benn versus Yerbly through the case of Deering to the case of Croft versus Snido, continuing on to the case of Martin versus Coleman, through the case of Weed, most recently the case of Irving versus DeVita, this court has preserved the free and fair exercise of all people, regardless of their station, of their testamentary right. For this court to concur with Bobby Cannaday's second assignment of error, it must overturn 160 years of jurisprudence, including every case I just listed. For this court to concur with the first assignment of error made by Bobby Cannaday, it must disagree or disbelieve Judge Garrett when he wrote, Mr. Hayden's testimony was not accepted as parole evidence of what the document means, but rather as corroboration of the genuineness of the document itself. And for this court to concur with the first assignment of error, it must also overrule every prior case holding that an appellant must preserve his objection at trial.
I take it you don't think we should do that.
Yes, Your Honor.
That was not a hostile question.
Understood.
I don't know.
But what Bobby Cannaday is asking this court to do is hostile. It's nothing short of a radical overhaul of what wills are, or what is required of wills to be proved. We suggest that instead of revising the landscape for proving a will, that we ask the court to reaffirm the precedence of its jurisprudence. And in many ways, this case is a 21st century doppelganger for the case of Croft versus Snyder. Both cases involved a three-page will. Both were held together in some form by a staple. But beyond that, witnesses in both cases could not identify any page other than the signature page where their signature occurred. In neither case did the witnesses know the contents of the wills. But this court held then, and it should do so today, that where subscribing witnesses identify their signatures but have no recollection of the instrument, the presumption is that it was properly executed and the document will be upheld in the absence of clear, satisfactory proof to the contrary. As opposing counsel pointed out in his argument, there was no evidence presented at trial by Bobby Cannaday. He had no witnesses. He had nothing but the suspicions and ignominious innuendo of counsel. Nothing beyond that. And, of course, counsel's comments aren't evidence. To paraphrase the Bean case, if the will of Robert Cannaday be not valid today, the law has, in this instance, signally and singly failed in its intended effect. Accordingly, we ask that the lower court's decision be upheld. Thank you.
Thank you. Rebuttal?
Your Honors, with respect to the second issue, in brief, we certainly indicated, as trial counsel had suggested to Judge Garrett, that the world would be a better place if we did require initials on pages of wills, and or perhaps people sign them. I know probably most lawyers have come up in a customary manner of having the witnesses and the testator sign, and or at least initial each page. And I think it's a good idea. I realize the legislature has not ruled that, but it certainly would cut down on these types of cases, because the problem is, and I think that what trial counsel was trying to get across to the court was that when you it's so easy with the computer-generated will to slip pages in and out. So this notion of actually having, and I think he referred to metadata, which I had not really considered before, but I think the point is to do everything that you can to make sure that a will is valid, and to make sure that it will not be and cannot be attacked in terms of whether or not it is a valid or invalid will. And so if those things that are addressed in the brief, I think, apply. We're asking the court to consider laudatory things that we all ought to be doing, but I agree that the General Assembly has not ruled in such a fashion. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Call the next case.